Good morning, good afternoon, or good evening, my fine friends. Welcome to the 7th episode of Season 8 of the Tom Petty Project podcast. I'm your host, Kevin Brown. This is the weekly podcast that digs into the entire Tom Petty catalogue, song by song, album by album, and includes conversations with musicians, fans, and people connected with Tom along the way. Some quick social media stuff before we dig in. The results of this week's poll. I gave Feel a Whole Lot Better 7 out of 10. The majority of the poll results agreed with me. So 57% of you rated it between 7 and 9. 29% of you gave the song a solid 10 out of 10. And only 14% rated it between 1 and 6. So that's good. We're in agreement, I think, more or less. Over on Facebook, Bob Reedy says that the album is Tom's masterpiece, at least in my mind. I love his version of that song. I found out years later that it was a cover of a Bird song. Love both versions. And yeah, isn't that true? Like, it sounds so much like a Heartbreakers song. And Pete Nestor, my friend Pete Nestor from the Honest and Unmerciful podcast. Eighth Burritos, Pete, really? You're going to allow that? Started his comment with a very nice allusion to the CD message from the album. He posted, "Hello, podcast listeners. Side 2 kicks off breezy and carefree. While there's no doubt Side 1 has the gargantuan hits, Side 2 is way more fun, and this track sets the tone. I don't care if it's a cover, it's a load of fun. It's nice to hear Tom letting loose a little. It feels like Side 1 was Tom's job interview, and Side 2 is the party after he's received his signing bonus check." I love this analogy, and there's definitely a distinct shift in tone between Side 1 and Side 2. You know, it's noticeable, and it's definitely deliberate, and I think the sequencing of the songs and choosing to load Side 1 up with all those hits, definitely sort of a conscious, intentional act. Carol Rosenberg Shapiro simply commented, "Best cover band ever." And the Fillmore box set proves that beyond a shadow of a doubt, I would say. I love bands that can cover a wide range of artists in concert. I'd just always rather hear original songs on studio albums. Again, that's just me. And Janet Lavelle commented, "Fantastic, better than the original." And I definitely agree with that one too. It's one of those strange songs that, like I said, you think that actually it makes more sense that that's a Heartbreaker song almost than a Bird song. P. Kaufman said he had to do a tribute to the Birds. It is classy to do that based on how heavily influenced he was by them. The song fits perfectly. A safe bet to start Side B on a happy and familiar note. And that's a good point too, that it's a fairly surefire winner to open the second side of the record because, you know, it's a known song. And to finish, Terry T-Bone Matley's comment, "I'm a big fan of the original, but Tom does it justice." And if you're looking for another podcast to check out, or go follow Terry on Facebook or on Instagram or Twitter, where all the places he is, look for T-Bone's Prime Cuts on the other side. Great podcast and a great guy. Thanks, as always, for your feedback and comments. Keep it coming. Today's episode covers track 2 from the second side of Full Moon Fever, fan favorite, You're So Bad. If you're new to the podcast, I don't play any of the music from the song in the episode to make sure that I'm not falling foul of copyright issues and to be respectful of the estate. If you want to give the song a listen before we dig into it, though, there's always a link in the episode notes. And sometimes I copy and paste the wrong link in there, and my eagle-eyed friend Paul Roberts lets me know immediately, and I can go and change that. So I'm going to start out with a very bold, a very strong statement. You're So Bad could almost be the most important song in the entire Tom Petty canon. Almost. Probably not the most important, to be honest, but it was the first song that Tom showed to Jeff Lynne. And from there, the rest of Full Moon Fever and then the Traveling Wilburys dropped effortlessly into place. And also, I think that recalibration for Tom and getting that love of the job back set him up for the rest of his career and the decades more that we got after this. In Paul Zolo's essential book, Conversations with Tom Petty, Paul asks Tom if George, and that's George Harrison, if he liked LA. And Tom answers, "I don't think he really liked LA. He complained a lot about the smog and it being overpopulated. But he had a lot of friends here. Among those friends, of course, were Jeff Lynne and Jim Keltner." And around this time, Tom and Jeff had been hanging out, you know, on and off, after their serendipitous meeting at a traffic light, and then again at a restaurant where Tom began his friendship with George Harrison. Tom tells Paul Zolo, "It was around this time that I showed Jeff one night that I had written the song You're So Bad. But there was one little bit in the B section where I didn't know where to go. He showed me this E minor chord, and that kind of opened it all up to me." And the story concludes with Tom asking Jeff, "Will you produce this?" And Jeff responding, "Sure, let's do it. Where should we record it?" The rest, of course, is rock and roll history made via Mike Campbell's spare bedroom, of all places. You're So Bad was the fifth and last single to be released from Full Moon Fever, and while it didn't chart on the Hot 100, it did reach number 5 on the Billboard Rock chart, as well as hitting number 44 up here in Canada. By the time of its release, Full Moon Fever had already been out for a full year, so I wonder if the wave had crested and was in retrograde at this point with the album. Had this been the second single from the album, I wonder if it possibly would have charted higher. I think maybe it probably would have done. One thing's for certain is that Tom Petty fans almost universally love this track. I can't remember ever seeing a negative word about this one in any of the online fan groups that I'm in, or among the casual fans that I know. I think it's partly because of the black humour of the lyrics, coupled with the very jaunty, fun beat that goes with the song. The track starts with a 4-count counting from Tom that has a slight delay on it to make it sound like two voices. After this, and in keeping with the majority of Full Moon Fever, the song just gets going. It gets to the point pretty quickly. We get that gorgeous strummed pattern on the 12-string guitar and a very short harmonised vocal. After 4 bars of that strummed A minor, Tom comes straight in with the vocal. I'm 95% sure, I'd even go so far as to say 99% sure, that there are 2 acoustic guitars in this track, one on the 12-string and one on a standard 6-string. So it'd be the typical setup of Mike and Tom playing complementary parts with possibly slightly different chord inversions to fatten up the sound, but I think the intro lick, at least, is both of them playing exactly the same pattern, you know, with the same chord positions. There's no drums or bass guitar or keyboards throughout this, you know, the intro and the first verse, so you really get to focus in on those guitars, the rhythm, and the words that Tom is singing. We rip through that brilliant first verse with only the addition of those harmonized R's again after the word singer. And man, what an opening lyric again from Tom Petty. Right away, you know this isn't going to be a big stadium anthem or any sort of personal tale. My sister got lucky, married a yuppie, took him for all he was worth. This is a tongue-in-cheek pastiche right from the opening line, and it only gets gloriously darker and funnier from there on out. It's another stunningly simple chord progression, A minor, G, D, back to A minor, through this section. And but when we get to the But Not Me, Baby pre-chorus, that's the B section that Tom was referring to struggling with. And that's when we get the drop to E minor, and then the whole band comes in. And when the band does come in, the time signature finally reveals itself. Up to this point, you probably would count this in 4-4 time, but with that great skiffle beat, I think it's probably actually better expressed as 2-4. The kick on the 1 and the snare on the 2 of each bar. Either way, whether it's 2-4 or 4-4, it just swings in a very, very cool way and gives you that old sort of 50s rhythm and blues feel. The pre-chorus also features very densely layered harmonies, which help build the song into a chorus which features a kick drum as one of the musical hooks. We also get a nice, light, broken chord lead guitar coming out of the pre-chorus and into the chorus. The chorus then sees that dum, da-dum, dum, da-dum kick drum motif along with the mandolin acoustic guitar C major chord on the words bad, had, and mad all throughout. Stunningly simple, yet beautifully constructed. I know I keep saying that on this record, but it's one of the main features of how this set of songs were written, worked up, recorded, and produced. Don't clutter them, but pack as much in as you can without losing any of the impact or the sonic separation. The lead out of the chorus hangs on the D chord, and then we hear a reprise of that compact little broken suspended chord that Mike Campbell plays on the lead. Before we get into the second verse with that, I would say, immortal line that Tom's written, I just wanted to comment on how much I love the snare sound on this song. As a drummer, I always have one ear out for the percussion in a song, and I love the way that Phil Jones plays this one. I wondered at first whether it was being played with brushes, but the more I've listened to it, I think it's more likely a nice big snare like a jazz snare, with the snare wires left nice and loose and rattly. It gives it such a distinctive sound, unlike anything else on the rest of the album. The progression of the second verse is pretty much identical to the first, but I think the mandolin comes in here full-time as well. It's just mixed a little bit lower, and it's not playing the full chord, maybe just some stabs. So as with most of the songs on this record, there's a ton of guitar, mandolin, stringed instruments all over this one. We also get that killer line. My sister's ex-husband can't get no lovin', walks around dog-faced and hurt. The first time I heard this song, that's the line that immediately stuck with me, especially as I'd never really heard that expression before. And while writing this episode, I decided to look for the origins of the phrase, and from what I found, it has ancient roots. So we're going all the way back here to the 7th or 8th century BCE. In Homer's Iliad, Achilles insults Agamemnon by calling him dog-faced, and Helen also self-deprecatingly refers to herself using the same term. Now, I don't know if in this context it's an old Floridian insult or quip, but it doesn't seem to have wide usage in a modern context, which just makes me love it all the more in this song. And my interpretation of it always means sort of, you know, that hound dog expression was just beaten down, worn out, and exasperated and done with life. That's what dog face means to me. The second chorus leads us into the solo. So again, the second chorus, same as the first. And the solo, it's kind of like feel a whole lot better. It's more of a vibe than a really clear melody or virtuosic bit of noodling. It's also multi-tracked with a second lead part coming in toward the end. And underneath that, you still have 12-string and 6-string acoustic guitar. And again, I'm pretty sure the mandolin is also in there mixed down low. The only word to describe this section is rich. The solo itself is mixed at pretty much the same level as the other guitars too, so this really adds to it feeling more like a texture than, you know, a lead melody or a spotlight part. We call it that, maybe a spotlight part. But as always, it's Mike Campbell playing exactly what the song needs. Okay, folks, it's time for some petty trivia. Your question from last week was this, and this was a nasty one, I think. And I don't know if no one sort of posted online that they got this, but if you did know this one, well, bloody well done. So the question was, Terry Melcher, born Terrence Jordan, was the producer who worked on the Byrds' 1965 album, Mr. Tambourine Man, which Feel a Whole Lot Better, last week's song, appears on. But which huge star of the silver screen was Terry Melcher the only son of? Was it A, Doris Day? B, Lauren Bacall, C, Grace Kelly, or D, Audrey Hepburn? The answer is A, Doris Day. His father was Day's first husband, Al Jordan, and he was adopted by her third husband, Martin Melcher, hence the surname. Most of his early recordings were with the vocal surf acts, the Ripcords, and Bruce and Terry. In the 1960s, Melcher was acquainted with the Beach Boys and later produced several singles for the group in the 80s and the 90s, including Kokomo in 1988, which topped the US chart. Melcher also has an odd link to Charles Manson. In 1968, Beach Boy Dennis Wilson introduced Melcher to ex-con and aspiring musician Charles Manson. Manson and his quote-unquote family had been living in Wilson's house at 14400 Sunset Boulevard after Wilson had picked up the hitchhiking Manson family members Patricia Krenwinkel, I think that's how you pronounce it, and Ella Jo Bailey. Wilson expressed interest in Manson's music and also recorded two of his songs with the Beach Boys. Manson eventually auditioned for Melcher, but Melcher declined to sign him. There was still talk of a documentary being made about Manson's music, but Melcher abandoned the project after witnessing Manson fighting with a drunken stuntman at Spahn Ranch. Wilson and Melcher then severed ties with Manson, a move which greatly angered him. Soon after, Melcher and Bergen moved out of the CeeLo Drive home. The house's owner then leased it to film director Roman Polanski and his wife, actress Sharon Tate. Manson was reported to have visited the house on more than one occasion asking for Melcher, but was told that he had moved. So, I mean, maybe a lucky escape. Who knows? So, a tenuous link to Petty, but I thought, you know, just a little bit of music history for you there, and I thought it was like a cool little story. So, the question for this week is this. So, last week we talked about a cover song by Tom, but which is the most covered song in Tom's catalogue? Is it A, Running Down a Dream, B, Breakdown, C, I Won't Back Down, or D, Learning to Fly? Okay, back to the song. Coming out of the solo, we head back into the pre-chorus and chorus, the latter of which is going to repeat. There's one subtle little vocal trick that Tom pulls out here, though, that I love. The first two times that Tom sings the line, but not me, baby, he rhymes the word me and the second syllable of the word baby. So, not me, baby. But in this last pass, he pronounces that second syllable differently, so much flatter, so baby, rather than baby. So that's, again, just a nice little twist. When we get to the end of this first chorus, everything drops out so that you can really hear that boom, ba-boom, kick drum part. And here you can also hear that a tambourine's been added to accent the snare. The chorus repeats one more time, and then we get what I always think of as a big Buddy Holly ending. No fade, just that syncopated rhythm guitar to finish. And I don't know if I'd ever really noticed until listening to it closely for this episode, but right as those last guitar chords are about to fade away, there's like a half-heard voice and then some whistling in the background. I've spoken before about my love of those things being kept in songs. Like Marcy Campbell's, it's just the normal noises in here, This little bit outside the song right at the end gives the whole thing a much looser, playful feel. One thing I haven't talked about at all in this one is the bass guitar, and that's because Jeff Lynne is just keeping that bottom end rolling along and not adding any sort of extra sauce or spice. That's all coming from the guitars and Tom's brilliant lyric. The song was a firm favourite in the live set, sitting just outside the top 10 most performed live tracks at 13th spot. According to setlist.fm, the song was played 308 times, including on every date of the 40th anniversary tour in 2017. There's a great version from the PBS soundstage performance where the song is played mainly solo by Tom, at least for the first sort of half, with big hard stops on the not me. That performance also features Steve Ferroni hamming it up unbelievably in the background, doing the actions for the lyrics in the pre-chorus, and clearly egging on the front row to join in with him. I'll leave a link to that one in the episode notes so you can give it a watch. You're So Bad is almost like a prototype for what the Wilburys would go on to become sonically. Whimsical, comical, bouncy, poppy, and supremely catchy music with wonderfully expressive lyrics. A song to really have fun with, and it shares that playfulness and polish that will become a signature of rock and roll's ultimate supergroup. Okay, Pettyheads, that's it for this week. Another week down. I'm not going to beat around the bush too much here. Like most fans, I adore this song. I love the lyrics, I love that wonderful skiffle beat, and I love the richly layered guitars and vocals. I also love that ending, it's just super cool. It's a simple little thing, really, but again, it throws back to the song's 50s rock and roll roots. And while I can't really put You're So Bad at the top table with the very best of Tom's catalogue, it's definitely on the table with the bride or groom's parents, and is being given access to the free bar for the evening. So I'm going to give You're So Bad an 8 out of 10. The Tom Petty Project is a proud member of the Deep Dive Podcast Network. Go check him out on Twitter at Deep Dive Podnet. There's lots of stuff, good stuff there. I'm sure you'll find something you like. You might also, if you want to listen to me talk about Queen, there's a podcast there called Seaside Pod Review, a Queen podcast, which I do with my very good friend, Randy Woods, who does all the interstitial music for this podcast. You could also find, it's not on the network yet, but the Ultimate Catalog Clash, which I'm doing with my friend Corey Morissette, the hardest working man in podcasting. This is his fourth podcast that he's doing. I guess it's my third, but this is fourth. And we're talking about Genesis. This week's episode was side two from Trick of the Tail. So go check that out and let me know what you think. Don't forget to follow me on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube at The Tom Petty Project and on Twitter at Tom Petty Project. I think my Threads handle actually that I have now is at The Tom Petty Project as well. So maybe I'll start posting on there and see if that takes off. I don't know. Don't really get it yet. So we'll see. Go follow, like, subscribe as applicable. And again, please leave a review or a rating if you haven't already. Keep talking to me on social media. And I'll keep reading out your tweets and your Facebook posts. I'd like that little bit of it. The Tom Petty Project is not affiliated with the Tom Petty Estate in any way. And when you're looking for Tom's music, please visit official streaming channels. Spotify, Apple Music, you know, all the places where you get your music. If you're looking for official merchandise, go to tompetty.com. If you're looking for podcast merchandise, you can go to tompettyproject.com. Don't forget to check out the Tom Petty Nation and Tom Petty Fans Forever groups on Facebook if you're not already a member of those groups, as they're excellent fan communities and well worth your time. Until we meet again next week, keep listening to and sharing Tom's music. Try to be kind. Try to say I love you to someone at least once a day. Stay safe and healthy, and I'll be back with you next week to talk about the next song from Side 2 of Full Moon Fever, Depending on You. Oh, my, my, my.